Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about natural resources. In particular, we're going to talk about conserving natural resources and then even more precisely, water. And it's an interesting story how we got today's guest. I was in Midland. I had to drive back and fill up with gas in that wonderful area of Van Horn. And right next to me in the parking lot of the petrol station was a federal truck. And I'm always interested to know, what do the feds do out there? So I said to the fellow, hey, what part of the federal government are you with? Thinking Homeland Security and interesting stories. And it turns out his name was Dr. Francisco Molinar, PhD, who is with the United States Department of Agriculture. And they're doing all this wonderful natural resource conservation studies out there with irrigation, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. And Francisco Molinar, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning. What made a young Francisco into a scientist? And we'll come on to what precisely that means in a moment.
I grew up in a farming community. My grandparents were farmers, and they have a little dairy in Old Mexico, in south central Chihuahua. They were pecan growers, cotton growers. They had a little farm, and they used to make cheese. So I used to be there all the time, observing, evaluating things. I wanted to know how things work out that way.
Did so you milk the cows?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Or is it goat's cheese too? Or?
No, not goats, just
okay.
Cows.
All right.
And we used to make cheese all the time. And it was very interesting to me to see how the process worked. I wanted to know more about it. So I decided to go to the agronomy school and start from there, my career in the natural resources.
So that's actually almost a change from the norm. I mean, normally people grow up on farms. You know, as young people get bored stiff and want to go to the big city. But no, you were fascinated by the transformation of cow's milk into cheese.
Always.
And hence began the career.
Yes.
So what did you go to study and where?
I study in Mexico, in Old Mexico. I studied in a university that was open in 1908, the School of Agronomy, Superior School of Agronomy, where I studied ag engineering. I finished in 1989. From there, I went to New Mexico State University to pursue a master's in horticulture. I decided then to go for a PhD in rain science because there were lots of opportunities in the conservation of the Chihuahuan Desert. We used to have a big ranch there. We called the Chihuahuan Desert Rangeland Research Center. I finished my PhD there at New Mexico State University.
So what was the research topic that you were doing for your doctoral degree?
We were evaluating range ecology, why mesquite is increasing and it's depleting the grasses that are edible for a lot of species, wildlife species. So it was basically range ecology.
And what did you conclude? Why is the mesquite sort of so rampant and cutting away all the grass?
Well, there are many reasons. The rangelands shaped themselves with fires. There were fires here every 50 years after the drought. Before the drought, there was a fire, and that fire will keep the mesquite. But we concluded that it's a lot of those causes are main man causes. That's why mesquite has been increasing. And basically, deep soils are more favorable for the encroachment of a mesquite. But mesquite is not bad at all. It's part of the ecosystem. And
is that the gobernadora?
No.
What tree is that?
No. Mesquite is it's a legume.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. If you drive to Van Horn, you're going to see mesquite everywhere.
It's a bush.
It's a bush.
Yeah.
It can
or
be
tree.
A tree,
right.
Yes. Depending on the water availability, it can turn into a tree. But it's a legume. It's beneficial. You know, it brings nitrogen to the soil. Like any other legume fixes
it's
nitrogen.
It's interesting. I mean, I think the idea of a tree being the same as a legume is rather entertaining. I never thought. Like, I know the old Middle Ages in Europe, they'd plant clover, you know, to enrich the soil every 3 years,
yes,
with nitrogen. But the mesquite as a permanent nitrogen fixer.
It is.
Right? Is interesting.
It's beneficial for the environment, for the soil.
Well, for itself.
For itself.
But not for the grass.
Well, I concluded that having a mesquite in the ranch is beneficial. But the problem is that mesquite encroaches. The cows, the animals are going to go for the grass, not for the mesquite.
Right.
Therefore, the competition is not fair for the grass. So the mesquite increases. There's less competition, and the grasses go down. It's basic competition species.
And so, I mean, did you conclude in the studies in that area that, in fact, range farming is going to be slowly disappearing?
No, sir. It's not. It can be self-sustainable even in the Chihuahuan Desert if we lower the range carrying capacity. Carrying capacity is the number of animals that are going to be grazing there. If we lower that, it's going to be beneficial. I foresee an increasing in animal grazing there with conservation practices because the grain prices are going up.
Uh-huh.
So we will grow more cows in the range under conservation. That's what I decided to go for, the conservation,
okay.
not to a resource conservation.
Right. So, I mean, then the bottom line then is that, okay, we've got a vast area. But the idea then is that you simply cut down the number of head of cattle that will be permitted to graze.
That is correct.
And then, of course, you've got natural resources. Well, there aren't many deer out in the desert. They're up in the foothills and the mountains, right?
Yes.
Right. And now I do know going up to the mountains every now and again, I'll see these oryx. You know, out there in the New Mexico area, on the McGregor Range, and
yes.
in and out of the White Sands.
Yes.
Are they a threat at all? Or
they're not native.
Beautiful to watch out. Oh, I know, but they're gorgeous, aren't they?
They're beautiful. They're dangerous. We as conservationists, we try to avoid them because they might be dangerous.
You mean
they're
may attack?
African. Yeah, they might attack you if you're in the desert cutting grass and you approach too close to the herd. Then.
I know I've been chased by them in the car, though I've been in a Jeep.
Yes.
And they like the competition, running along the side of the road, well, the desert trail, actually. But I never think of them as dangerous.
They like open
the horns
range.
Look pretty grim, though.
They're from the African savanna.
Right. Okay. So and after that, then, you sort of realized that maybe conservation was the area that, and sustainability, I goes with that,
that
was your area of interest. So then you joined the United States Department of Agriculture. Tell us, what's their interest in this whole Southwest Chihuahua Desert region?
Well, the Chihuahuan Desert region, we're part of it. We're in the middle of it. It extends from southern New Mexico to north central Mexico. We have limited natural resources. Precipitation is very limited. Rain is very erratic. Soils are thin. Evaporation is high. So to make those areas productive, we have to use a lot of conservation efforts, a lot of conservation strategies, do a lot of thinking, do a lot of planning, and do a lot of implementing. We have several practices that can target all those conservation efforts.
Before you get on to the areas that you're doing work on to increase productivity or maintain, tell me in a sort of an intellectual point, why is it important to take a desert region and make it into a productive agricultural region? Why not just leave it alone for what it is and say, well, we'll just have agriculture where it's naturally beneficial and simple to do it?
The urban areas in the Chihuahuan Desert, within the Chihuahuan Desert, are expanding. We have urban sprawls in El Paso, Phoenix, Tucson, Chihuahua, Mexico, Juarez, our neighbor, and different other cities, Torreon, Mexico. So the population is increasing. Therefore, we have to supply food and fiber for all that population.
That's not chicken and egg, though, isn't it? Because if you couldn't do it, then these places – I mean, I'm always amazed when you come to this part of the world. I came from England, and all of a sudden you're flying in from Dallas or from wherever, and you're looking down and you're thinking, where are the people? Where are the trees? Where's the water? And then you suddenly arrive in Albuquerque or in Tucson or El Paso, Juarez, and you say, gosh, all these people, how do they all survive? And, of course, they survive by all sorts of methodologies. Obviously, growing food somewhere else and bringing it in is the main feature.
Right.
And so one argues with oneself, is it sensible, you know, to sort of facilitate more and more people coming in?
We highly depend on fossil fuels to do all that.
Right. And so the question is then, maybe if we weren't so clever at transforming the desert from time to time. I mean, when you go down to, what is it, Yuma? Well, yes. You go down there and you're on the way to Yuma, and then you, if your top is down, you can start smelling these wonderful citrusy smells. And then you come across these orange groves that go on for, mile after mile after mile in the middle of the desert.
Right.
And then you read that the Colorado River is getting less and less water available for California, for Mexico. Am I wrong to think that this is perhaps a pig-headed way to approach agriculture?
You know, several crops get benefit from this environment. Cotton is one example. Pima cotton, which is a variety of cotton that we grow here in El Paso, was introduced in 1946. That cotton has very particular places in the world where it grows because it needs hot days and cold nights. So that increases the quality of the fiber. El Paso is one of these areas. Juarez is another area. Egypt is another area with Pima cotton growth. And it's drought tolerant. It tolerates droughts. In fact, we're in the middle of the drought that has been extended for 16 years. And our producers are growing cotton, which is drought tolerant. This climate is beneficial. Of course, we have to reduce the amount of acres.
If I was saying driving up the Mesilla Valley from El Paso up to Mesilla or Las Cruces and beyond, so then you see the cotton, you see a little bit of Chile, and then you see pecan farm after pecan farm after pecan farm. And I'm not a pecan lover. Macadamia nuts, I like walnuts, but I've never really got into pecans. But pecans look like an incredibly water-demanding crop. Am I right, or am I wrong on that? Is that also a drought tolerant sort of
agriculture? No, it's not. Pecan is not drought tolerant. In fact, this last 3 years, pecan growers have been in a difficult situation. But that's where conservation jumps in. Through water management, we have different strategies to manage the water and reduce the amount of water that those trees are using. We're switching from flawed irrigation to micro-irrigation, so in which you inject the water to specific areas of the root to minimize the impact and reduce up to 70% of the water that those trees are using.
70%?
It could be 70%. It's a substantial reduction.
I mean, I'm one of these Neanderthals that likes a little bit of grass around my home coming from Britain. I mean, I needed a little bit of grass.
Right.
But several years ago, I went to the underground irrigation
rather
than just spraying it on and seeing most of it evaporate before your eyes.
That is correct.
You could see the droplet just getting smaller and smaller until it finally hit the ground. So now that same technology is important.
It's available now, and we're implementing it. We started our new first pilot project this year. We see how it works. In New Mexico, it's more common and common and common every day. There's another thing that I want to mention. You talk about all those pecan orchards along the Rio Grande Valley. The water table there is pretty shallow. So there's water available for those deep roots. That's why you see most of the pecans in that area, because the water table there is shallow.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Dr. Francisco Molinar, who works for the United States Department of Agriculture with specific interest in natural resource conservation. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Francisco Molinar from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, specialist on natural resource conservation, in particular water. So, Francisco, we were talking then about the capacity of the pecan tree to have deep roots that can get to the water table in our area and other areas too. And yet we still have to have that large flooding process that you see. So it looks to me, as an ingenue, that all the water that these trees were getting came from the top and going down. That clearly was a mistake on my part.
You're going to see more and more the use of micro-irrigation.
Tell us exactly, how does that work?
Water is more limited every day. I attended a meeting a week ago, and they told us that for us to be able to have water again in the dams upstream, Elephant Butte and Caballo Lake, we have snowpack, precipitation up to 150%. the normal for a couple of years, just to go back to normal. Therefore, we have to think about water conservation. It's a serious issue right now. By using micro-irrigation and other precision agriculture techniques that I will mention to you, one of them is land leveling. So we level those fields, and we leave those fields completely level to allow water to flow better, and that also reduces the water usage if those fields are flood irrigation. We're starting to use pipelines to conduct the water and avoid evaporation. That's another practice that we're implementing here in this area. For pecans in particular, we're lining a lot of dirt ditches to avoid seepage and promote the conservation. We use a lot of techniques. We use precision agriculture. We level with satellite technology to level those fields and leave them flat. So we use a lot of practices.
But the idea of delivering water, like in my underground irrigation, subsurface irrigation for my lawn, is that practical for farming and for pecan growing to have all of the delivery underneath the soil to the roots?
It's practical. Of course, right here in El Paso, we're in a pilot project. But we have seen the success that a lot of growers have in Tula Rosa, New Mexico, where they are implementing the subsurface irrigation practices.
For pecans?
For pecans.
All right. And if it works for that, it could work for almost anything.
It could work for us, yes.
Is that going to change the way that the fields look? I've seen two types of pecans. I've seen the pecan orchards, mainly, I must say, up in this region, where in between the trees there's nothing. All right, it just looks just soil. Mm-hmm. And then I got a good friend in Delicias, mm-hmm. well, actually Jimenez down in Mexico, mm-hmm. where in between the pecan trees there's all grass. Mm-hmm. Right? And, yeah. and presumably that's just flooding. It was never there when they
right.
were watering.
Right.
So that's going to make a different view to what these orchards look like?
I don't know here in El Paso, but it will be beneficial to keep that soil cover.
Uh-huh.
Because we have severely dust storms. And
right.
erosion is a big problem here. In my work here, if we plant between the rows a legume, let's say alfalfa,
yeah.
So the alfalfa can bring the nitrogen, some of the nitrogen, not all, but some of the nitrogen required by those trees.
So in fact, then the answer is not just efficiency and utilization of the water, but sort of multiple crops in the same field at the same time, especially for orchards.
That is correct.
All right. So is that becoming the norm?
I don't want to say it's becoming, but it's a good strategy.
It's a good strategy.
Yes, and you see it more and more.
And so tell us a little bit about the experimental ranch you say that you have. Is up in Tula Rosa?
No, this is not experimental ranches.
Oh.
No, no.
Well, is there one?
Producers, private companies have those systems apply. They apply those micro-irrigation systems.
So there never has been a sort of a government-run experimental ranch?
The USDA Department of Agriculture has a branch that do research. It's the Agricultural Research Service.
But it's not in this region, though?
No, not in this region.
So on a day-to-day basis, what does your work entail?
You know,
maybe people out there say, oh, this is like a good career.
Yes.
I mean, what's Francisco Molinar do all day?
Well, I'm the district conservationist. I cover El Paso, Hotspit, and Culberson County. I'm the team leader. I have another conservationist in Van Horn, Texas, and we cover 3 million acres of rangelands and cropland. We have several projects going on from farming. All our farming here is irrigated to wildlife conservation, deer, pronghorn, quail, different wildlife species. So we cover a lot of ground. And my office is located here in El Paso, but I'm in the field all the time. I drive my pickup truck. I go everywhere. I go check practices. I do land leveling. I have a rover for my satellite to download my satellite imagery. I work on my computer a lot of times, and I do a lot of administration work also.
Right. That comes with the territory, right?
Yes.
At the end, there's the fun, there's the work, and then there's the paperwork.
It's a lot of fun.
Right.
It's a
Do you have any interesting stories that you can tell when you're out there in the field? I mean, this is a region where I've been out in that region, and you see a lot of military, you see a lot of Homeland Security, and they're always inquisitive of what people are doing. Do you ever get interactions of that nature?
Well, you know that this area, we share a common border with Mexico, and it's very open. And there are too many white pickup trucks out there. We drive a white pickup truck, and our agency is a Natural Resource Conservation, NRCS. So not many law enforcement know what NRCS is. So we've been stopped by Border Patrol, Homeland Security, Texas Department of Public Safety, and they ask us what we're doing there. We've been chased by helicopters, by the sheriff, and we also have to stop and give them an explanation of what we're doing there and why.
So you have to whip out your federal IDs?
Yes, and, right? All of that.
Change the color of the truck, you know, make it red, white, and blue or something, you know, a star and stripe on the top.
Well, now I have the USDA logo, so they know what the USDA is.
So it's a matter of education.
I have a different strategy now. If I'm going to be out in the field, I call Border Patrol and let them know that I'm going to be there.
Okay.
So they know that somebody from the same team is going to be in the area doing research or doing work.
That reminds me. I have a fellow that does my hair. Frank, I've had it done there ever since I came to America, and he's moved from upscale to somewhat downscale, I'll say. But he's a great fisherman, and he's always going down just beyond Fort Hancock to these big holes in the Rio Grande to get catfish. Does that come under the USDA? You know, I mean, agriculture, farming, fishing?
Not in this area.
Not in this area.
Not
those few catfish.
No. There are other areas in the country where they have the USDA manages marshes, conservation of marshes, wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
No, we don't have that, those areas here. We don't have those ecosystems here in the desert.
No.
But, yeah, it's part of the USDA NRCS.
So what's your future? What's your immediate challenge? Like when you leave this studio, you're going to go and – assuming you finished your paperwork, you're going to go back onto the field. What are you going to do for the rest of this week and next week?
For the rest of this week, I have land leveling projects. We're short of personnel right now. So I'm going to do all the technical work.
You mean you have to get in one of these big land leveling instrument machines?
Now it's pretty simple. In the old times, we used to do topography the old-fashioned way with the transit and the tripod and all of that and a lot of calculations. Nowadays, I have a tripod and a plate that gets the signal from the satellites and then a rover. My pickup truck is a rover, so every 50 feet, every 100 feet takes a shot, an elevation. And all of that is based in the Bluetooth technology and satellite technology that is coming from the sky.
And this is public land or private land?
No,
or?
We only work on private lands and tribal lands.
Okay, so you have to be invited by the landowner to come and do this.
That is correct.
So a large amount of what you do is going around educating landowners about what the potential of their land is.
That is correct.
Do you get many people that resent? I mean, you read up in places like Reserve New Mexico, when the USDA or the U.S. anything goes in, there's an antagonism.
Right.
You know, what do I need the government coming onto my land? Is that
right?
Do you ever encounter anything like that?
Yes, I've done, especially with old-fashioned producers. But, you know, we're all changing because of the weather and because of the way I approach to those producers. I grew up in a farming community, so I know how they think.
So you know the language.
I know the language. Yes. And also, I worked many years ago as an extensionist, an agricultural extensionist in South America, in Brazil. I was in areas with different types of producers. So I learned how to be, not only how to be a scientist and an administrator, also how to be an extensionist. An extensionist is somebody that goes to the field and extends the research, the knowledge, to all of these producers in simple terms. So I know how to play the different roles.
Did you ever go up into the mountains at all? Is that part of the territory?
It's part of
the Sacramento Mountains.
We go to the Sacramentos, right. The Eagles, the Guadalupes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And when you're up there, I mean, presumably the product, if there is any product, well, what is the product? What's an agricultural product that comes out, apart from ranching, up in the mountains?
Well, wildlife, particularly bighorn sheep.
Ah.
We have ranches here in our area that have bighorn sheep.
Where?
Sierra Blanca, Texas.
Let me finish off by sort of asking you to be a bit of a Cassandra and a prognosticator. How long do you think, with all of the technology that we are being able to bring to bear on this, that agriculture in any significant fashion can survive in this great Chihuahua Desert region?
Resources are limited, and they're not going to – I don't think in the short term it's going to change. So we see a decrease in the acreage of farmland. However, we have to be more productive. Those have to be more productive. The only way to keep those areas producing is through precision agriculture. We use seeds that are or plants that are drought resistant.
So genetic modification is a big part of what this region needs.
It's a big part of it. Not only this region, all over the world. Remember that by the year 2050, the world population is going to double. So we have to increase the production that we have.
Yes. All right. You've been listening to Science Studio. It's a fascinating program. I mean, Francisco Molinar from the United States Department of Agriculture, you've shown us how it can be, how it is, and what it will be. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Norma Martinez, thank you for putting this show together. And we thank you, the listener out there, for enjoying these programs. And we'll be back next week with another program. Take care.